Our next speaker is Professor Bernhard Meyer, a historian of the study of religion in the 19th century. He studied comparative religion, comparative linguistics, Celtic philology, and Semitics at several universities in Great Britain and in Germany. Has taught at the University of Aberdeen before his appointment as professor of Allgemeine Religionswissenschaft and Europäische Religionsgeschichte at the University of Tübingen. Besides numerous publications in his native German, he has authored several books in English, among them Semitic Studies in Victorian Britain, a portrait of William Wright and his world through his letters, and an intellectual biography of William Robertson Smith, which is the topic that he will speak to us about today, entitled Schechter's Review of, Solomon Schechter and William Robertson Smith. Professor Meyer.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the generous introduction. And before I begin, I would also like to thank the organizers of the conference for the very kind invitation to come here. Now, any fresh discussion of Solomon Schechter's relations with his Cambridge colleague, William Robertson Smith, has to make allowance, I think, for three factors which make real progress a little difficult. Firstly, direct contact between Schechter and Smith was confined to a relatively short period of time, namely less than 5 years, during which time Smith was frequently ill and consequently not resident in Cambridge at all. Secondly, it has to be said that there is not much written evidence, so that several hints and clues that have come down to us are difficult to interpret, and our understanding of them is sometimes based on inference and reasoning by analogy rather than on any certain information. And thirdly, it must be recalled that the topic has already been dealt with both skillfully and in great detail in a paper which Professor Stefan Reif contributed to the 1994 Centenary Congress on Robertson Smith. So in what follows, I shall try to examine and interpret some hitherto neglected supplementary evidence, and I shall also try to present this evidence in a wider biographical and historical perspective. Focusing on the life and times of Robertson Smith, one obviously needs to consider the cultural and religious milieu into which he was born, the influence of theological value judgments that he acquired in the course of his studies and academic career, the personal example set by teachers, colleagues, and friends, and last but not least, his own personal contact with Jews and Judaism. On the one hand, all of these factors constitute, as it were, a kind of seamless garment, but on the other hand, we also need to make allowance for subtle or even for profound changes in Smith's attitudes towards Jews and Judaism. So let us begin by examining the milieu into which he was born. How do I get to the next slide? This one. Now, considering the intellectual and spiritual atmosphere that prevailed in the Free Church of Scotland during the 1840s and 1850s, thank you. When Smith was a child, it is commonly assumed that the dominant note was one of seriousness and austerity, not to say despondency and gloom. However, I think it deserves to be stressed that to a certain extent, appearances may well be deceiving. This is obviously true of the famous painting, The Ordination of Elders in a Scottish Kirk, which was created in 1891 by John Henry Lorimer and is now on display in the National Gallery of Scotland. Although the room depicted here was not a church and none of those depicted was an elder, the painting continues to be praised for its realism, which suggests that it reflects the popular image of Victorian Scottish Presbyterianism rather than the historical reality. A similar point, I think, can be made about a series of letters to the editor of The Scotsman, which Professor John Rogerson quoted in his 1994 Gifford Lectures on Faith and Criticism in the Work of William Robertson Smith, in order to illustrate the intellectual backwardness of many Free Church ministers. These letters were originally published during the Robertson Smith heresy trial, and in one of them it is demanded, that's about the eighth line from below, that the teaching of Hebrew, and particularly biblical criticism, should henceforth be discontinued in our colleges, end of quote. The letters are stated to have been written at the Free Church Manse of Kilbogie by the Reverend Alexander McCraw, and they sound convincing enough until you consult official documents and realise that there is no Scottish village called Kilbogie, and there never was a Reverend Alexander McCraw. In point of fact, the letters were a hoax, concocted by Smith's supporter, Alexander Nicholson, whom you can see here in full Highland dress among his Aberdeen and Edinburgh friends, with Robertson Smith sitting in the front. Incidentally, there are two friends from Aberdeen at the back. To the left, you can see George Read, later Sir George Read, who painted the famous portrait of Robertson Smith, which is now in Cambridge. And to the right, you can see an Aberdeen businessman, John Forbes White. He was the favourite student of Professor John Stuart Blackie, who was mentioned in Professor Soskis's talk. He was the somewhat eccentric professor of Greek in the University of Edinburgh, who had this extraordinary idea that Homeric Greek should be pronounced like modern Greek. He also didn't call him White, he called him Lefkos. Now, what I would like to stress is that far from being uniformly exclusivist and narrow-minded, the early Free Church of Scotland did in fact accommodate a wide variety of viewpoints and also a certain openness of mind, as we shall see when we look at Robertson Smith's later career. Considering Smith's earliest acquaintance with Jews and Judaism, it must be recalled that he grew up in a Free Church manse that was situated in an extremely rural part of Aberdeenshire in the northeast of Scotland. So below to the right you can see the manse as it looks today, and to the left you can see the view that is to be had if you step out of the front door onto the road and look west across the Vale of Arfert towards the Grampian Mountains. Pictures were taken a few years ago. Due to the circumstances of his upbringing, Smith's earliest acquaintance with Jews, Judaism, Hebrew and the Hebrew Bible would have been entirely through the religious education that his father and mother provided for their children, for there was no formal schooling at the time. As we know from a detailed description left by Smith's younger sister Alice, a chapter from the Old Testament would be read at family worship every morning, all the Psalms from the Scottish Psalter would have to be learnt by heart, and on Sunday afternoons, Smith's mother would use colourful cards and pictures to familiarise the children with biblical stories. Smith's father, a former school director, was of a rather scholarly bent, recalling many years later that his firstborn son, William, I quote, learned the Hebrew alphabet so as to read the words of the language before the age of six, end of quote. On the other hand, there were hardly any opportunities of making contact with Jews or with Judaism as a living religion. As Smith's sister Alice recalled in her old age, after she had been living in Germany for many years, and now I quote the passage from her memoirs in translation, "Once there came to our home Hawker, a German Jew who peddled pictures. This was a rather special event, and both Lucy," that's her younger sister, "and I were allowed to buy a picture. I chose a coloured print of Dr. Martin Luther, one of my heroes. My sister chose something else." Then our brother joined us and engaged in a German conversation with the peddler, which pleased us greatly, end of quote. Yet despite such stray encounters, Jews, and especially observant Jews, were only rarely to be seen in rural Aberdeenshire, and the Aberdeen Hebrew congregation was not formed until 1893, the year before Robertson Smith died. Thus, one suspects that many Aberdonians would have regarded Jews and Judaism as somewhat exotic. This assumption would seem to be confirmed by an incident that relates to the well-known portrait of Robertson Smith, which was painted by his artist friend George Read in 1877 and now hangs above the fireplace in the Mountbatten Room in Christ's College. As Smith told his younger brother Charles when the portrait was first exhibited in February 1877, I quote from a letter, "George Read's portrait of me is now in Edinburgh, where it is, I understand, admired as one of the best things he has done. The Aberdeen Journal, in noticing it, spoke of my unmistakably Jewish features. Not a bad joke, the source of which, I suspect, is a mystification Read played off on Bow." Bow is the Scottish landscape painter, Samuel Bow. "Bow, with his usual rude swagger, asked Read, 'Is your friend a Jew?' To which Read seriously answered, 'Of course, don't you see it?' Bao had no doubt been talking again to the critic, who had probably never seen a Jew himself. End of quote. In this context, it is perhaps also worth noticing that the literary critic William Ernest Henley, top right, he was a friend of Robert Louis Stevenson and is said to be the model of Long John Silver in Treasure Island. Henley, many years later, began a vitriolic article on Robertson Smith by attributing Smith's origin to a chance visit of the wandering Jew to Aberdeen. Smith's biographers, pardon me, Smith biographers John Sutherland Black and George Crystal commented on this article by noting that, I quote, it displayed much of the literary hooliganism which was his, that is Henley's, favourite affectation, end of quote. And they stated that the remark about the wandering Jew was, in a vein of pleasantry, now happily obsolete. On the other hand, Black and Crystal themselves referred to Smith's outward appearance by writing, I quote, his face as a whole had, curiously enough, a certain suggestion of the East in it, a characteristic which Smith himself energetically repudiated, end of quote. Now, although it is difficult to know what exactly Smith's ideas with respect to race and racism were, it is probably safe to say that he was convinced not only of the superiority of Christianity above non-Christian religions, but presumably also of the superiority of Europeans above non-Europeans. Moving on to Smith's formation as a scholar and his later academic career, I think it is worth examining the attitude towards Jews and Judaism of those scholars with whom he was in close contact and with whom he regarded as teachers and or friends. One of the first that comes to mind is Paul de Lagarde, whom Smith first got to know at the same time as Julius Wellhausen, namely during his second stay at Göttingen in the summer of 1872. As is well known, Lagarde was ferociously anti-Jewish, and his writings were a major influence on many later German anti-Semites. To the best of my knowledge, there is no direct evidence from which we might infer Smith's attitude towards Lagarde's anti-Semitism, but it is perhaps significant that in Smith's letters to Lagarde, which seem to be extant as a whole, the loving attention which Smith bestows on questions of Hebrew and Syriac philology contrasts rather sharply with the somewhat vague and lukewarm remarks that he passes on Lagarde's religious or ideological writings. However, as Lagarde was contemptuous not only of Jews and Judaism, but also of his Göttingen colleague Albrecht Ritschl, who was at that time Smith's favourite theologian, it is difficult to know whether Smith disliked Lagarde's theology or his aggressive racism, or both. In this connection, it would of course be interesting to know whether Smith had any personal experience of anti-Semitism during his sojourns and travels in Germany. Certainly there would have been opportunities for it, as we know from the experience of other travellers. So just by way of example, one might quote the experience of the Welsh educationalist Owen Morgan Edwards, seen here to the left, who travelled through Germany on his way from Bala in Wales to Geneva in Switzerland in the autumn of 1887. Like Smith, Edwards was strongly influenced by 19th century Calvinism, and during his journey, he not only met with a good deal of German anti-Semitic prejudice, but also absorbed it and reproduced it in a rather uncritical fashion. As another witness, one might quote Robertson Smith's fellow Scotsman, Cambridge student Ian Keith Falconer, seen here to the right, who experienced German anti-Semitism during his stay in Leipzig in the winter of 1880, writing home in a letter, I quote, Delitzsch, that's of course Professor Friedrich Delitzsch, Delitzsch, I suppose you know, has just published a pamphlet called Falsche Waage ist nicht gut, in reply to Rohling's Talmud-Jude. Rohling is a German Catholic priest and bigoted to an absurd degree against the unfortunate Jews, who are universally disliked in Germany. I asked a gentleman the other day, woran erkennen Sie denn einen Juden? Answer, an seinem allgemeinen brutalen Wesen. This gives the keynote to the general anti-Jew agitation in Germany. No specific charge against them as a body, only a strong antipathy to the Jew. Now, due to the paucity of our sources, for most of Smith's letters from Germany appear to be lost, we know of only one incident in which Smith was actually confronted with anti-Semitism in Germany. This happened when he was travelling the length and breadth of Germany together with his artist friend George Reed in the spring of 1876. The episode is not mentioned in the 1912 biography of Smith, But the book does, in fact, contain a drawing that George Read had made of Smith on that occasion. Here we see Smith gesticulating with his right and grabbing with his left what looks like the carrying strap of a knapsack. However, a look at the full picture reveals that we are, in fact, in the middle of a quarrel in a railway compartment in which Smith and a Jewish rabbi argue with a Protestant clergyman who declares with outstretched forefinger that he is in his own country and will have his right. So that's the speech bubble. Ich bin in meinem eigenen Lande und will mein Recht haben. With the clergyman's bride sitting by the window, indignantly muttering, höchst ungezogen, most naughty. As we learn from the text that accompanies the scene in the original travel diary from which this picture was taken, Smith had grabbed the strap with which passengers could lower the window in the railway compartment because the rabbi had begun to feel unwell in the close air, upon which the Protestant clergyman fiercely declared that the rabbi had absolutely no right to fresh air, claiming that, I quote from the diary, this was the fruit of the unrighteous emancipation of the Jews. The fact that Smith in this case sided with the rabbi against his Protestant colleague is probably not entirely coincidental, as Smith seems to have been very sensitive to all forms of incivility, as was noted, for instance, by his later Cambridge friend James George Frazer. Nevertheless, one should obviously not exaggerate the significance of an isolated incident. To return to Smith's academic peers, it is worth taking a closer look at the case of Theodor Noldeker, seen here in the middle, who may serve to show just how complex and at times bewildering scholarly attitudes towards Jews and Judaism in those days could be. Priding himself on what he held to be an entirely non-religious rationalism, Noldeker was perfectly disgusted by contemporary German anti-Semitism and did not mince his words in telling people so. Thus, he was asked more than once to give evidence in court, using his expert knowledge to counter popular anti-Jewish prejudice. It must be stressed, however, that Noldeker's self-proclaimed rationalism was not without its blind spots either, for while he sneered at Lagarde's anti-Semitism, he did in fact hold rather similar negative ideas about other peoples that were hardly better founded. Moreover, like many academics at the time in Germany, Noldeker was explicitly critical of all forms of religion, including Judaism. So when in 1889 his friend and colleague, the Jewish librarian Samuel Landauer, had his little son circumcised, Noldeker told a former student, Snooker Gronje at Leiden, that, I quote, such barbarian practices ought to be banned by the police in our countries, end of quote. And when in 1906 the Jewish librarian Jakob Fromer promoted the complete assimilation of the Jews, Noldeker strongly supported his ideas, which in turn led Hermann Cohen to charge Noldeker now with anti-Semitism. In this connection, it is probably worth noting that Smith in later years clearly had to come to terms with a wide variety of scholarly attitudes and standpoints due to his editing the 9th edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, to which Noldeker, of course, was a significant contributor. However, the necessity of engaging with and mediating contradictory claims must have been familiar to him from the mid-1870s, when he joined the Old Testament Company of the Committee for the Revision of the Authorized Version of the Bible. This company also included such scholars as Christian David Ginsburg, who had converted from Judaism to Christianity at the age of 15. As Archibald Henry Sayce, yet another member of the company, noted many years later in his memoirs, again I quote, Ginsburg shared Dr. Johnson's antipathy to Scotchmen, and on one occasion when some obscure point was carried by the votes of the Scotch members, he shouted out, oh, you may call that Scotch theology, I call it swindling. End of quote. Now, returning once more to Smith's friends and colleagues, it is probably also worth noting that a certain sense of rivalry, competition, and sometimes jealousy does not appear to have originated in religious or denominational differences, but rather in the fact that Jewish and non-Jewish scholars approached the Hebrew Bible and related literature from different standpoints, but were ultimately competing for the same sources of private funding and public appreciation. This aspect, I think, may be illustrated by the case of Robertson Smith's friend and colleague at Cambridge, William Wright, whom you see here in the middle. Like Theodor Neldecke, who was among his closest friends, Wright was religiously largely indifferent, and his private letters clearly indicate that his professional judgment on colleagues was based on the quality of their scholarship and their adherence to scholarly standards, rather than on their religious convictions. Thus, Wright found words of generous praise for Abraham Geiger, but rather scathing remarks for Immanuel Deutsch, whom he appears to have regarded as some kind of humbug. In particular, Wright appears to have found it rather galling that public at large considered Deutsch to be an expert on Oriental literature, while Wright held him to be a popularizer rather than an original scholar. In the parlance of the period, criticism of scholarly deficiencies could, of course, easily be couched in terms that we would now consider to be racist. Thus, William Wright told his friend Neldecke in a letter written in March 1889 that David Samuel Margoliouth's election to the Lordian Professorship of Arabic at Oxford was above all due to the ignorance of the election board. And he said in this letter, I quote, "Mr. Margoliouth, though a Christian by profession, is only, I believe, one remove from a Jew and has all the faults of his race. Ask some of your classical scholars about his Aeschyle Agamemnon, in which he ventured to rewrite Aeschylus." End of quote. And it has to be said that Robertson Smith was also highly critical of Margoliouth. And there is a letter to the Irish historian Alice Stopford Green in which Smith puns on Margoliouth's name, calling him, I quote, "that silly, though clever, young fellow Margoliouth, a real pearl of Jewish acuteness and absurdity, as his name suggests." End of quote. And finally, of course, it must be remembered that then as now, alliances as well as enmities and animosities between scholars could result from very material considerations of funding and resources. Thus, there seems to have been a major quarrel between William Wright, Robertson Smith, and Schechter's predecessor at Cambridge, Solomon Marcus Schiller-Sinnerschie, towards the end of 1887. And there is a confidential letter which Wright sent to his old Dutch friend Jan de Rooye at Leiden, where he says, again I quote, "I never intend to see or speak to Mr. Schiller-Sinnerschie again, except it be officially, nor does Robertson Smith, nor, I think, Aldous Wright. At a meeting of the Board of Oriental Studies before Christmas, without any warning, he all at once made a most ferocious attack in the foulest hound's ditch on me and Smith, called us his worst enemies in this university, denounced me as an impostor, Robertson Smith as a liar, shaking his fist in his face, and raved and howled like a madman. The whole origin of the thing I believe to be that Robertson Smith and I wanted to get established a lectureship in Aramaic, in the widest sense, with a salary of £100 a year, of course with an eye to Bensley's holding it now and perhaps Bevan afterwards. I imagine that Mr. Schiller-Sinnerschie thought this would in some way interfere with his lecturing on the Targums, or that the money would in some mysterious fashion be plucked out of his pocket. After the scene at the board, Mr. Schiller-Sinnerschie got up a row with Bensley in the street and reviled him similarly, I am told." End of quote. Now, significantly, Wright afterwards labelled this letter with a note reading, "Please destroy this straw," which de Rooye didn't do, so one suspects that this type of conflict, on the whole, may have been more frequent than our evidence that has come down to us would suggest. So, in conclusion, what may we take to have been the main factors which prompted Robertson Smith to support Solomon Schechter and the principles that guided his professional relations with him? On the one hand, as Professor Reif pointed out long ago, Smith was strongly influenced by the traditional deprecation of rabbinic Judaism, which has its roots in the New Testament and which was certainly very much alive in the Protestant biblical higher criticism. This surfaces perhaps most clearly in Smith's lectures on the Old Testament in the Jewish Church, published in the spring of 1881, when he was still hoping to continue teaching in the Free Church College Aberdeen. On the other hand, Smith was obviously also very much in touch with those segments in the Free Church of Scotland that cultivated a certain liberalism, tolerance, and openness of mind. More decisively, perhaps, I think, the loss of his Aberdeen chair and his subsequent appointment at the University of Cambridge may be seen as a turning point not only in Smith's professional career, but also in his attitude towards religious and denominational differences. On the one hand, the loss of his Aberdeen chair appears to have entailed a certain estrangement from his church, so that theological value judgments became less important than they used to be. Significantly, Smith's theological correspondence with Albrecht Ritschl, which he had been conducting for many years, appears to have ceased at about that time, and Smith's interest in social anthropology increased as his involvement in ecclesiastical affairs diminished. Moreover, we know from a confidential letter, yet another confidential letter, which William Wright sent his close friend Theodor Noldeker, that Smith's appointment to the Lord Almoner's readership at Cambridge was mainly due to the good offices of Wright's brother-in-law, Richard Frederick Littledale, who was one of the leading representatives of the English High Church movement. If Smith knew of this, it would probably have confirmed his suspicion that a decent and fair treatment was, after all, independent of religious convictions and not always to be had from those quarters from which you had expected it. In sum, I would suggest that Smith's support of Solomon Schachter very much reflects his growing insight that religious convictions are to a large extent shaped by biographical factors. Significantly, in a letter written immediately after the end of the heresy trial, Smith told Abraham Kühnen, whom he had fiercely criticized at the outset of his career, that he had come from a very different background, but that every year of study had made him think more highly of Kühnen's work. 1 year later, when Kühnen sent Smith a copy of his Hibbert lectures on national religions and universal religions, Smith told the author that what he had, I quote, found most instructive and what is certainly most necessary at present is your vindication of Judaism. End of quote. The fact that popular ideas about Judaism were all too often due to unsympathetic outsiders and that biographical differences accounted in large measure for differences in perception was of course also highlighted by Solomon Schachter, who in an 1891 review article on The Law and Recent Criticism noted that most modern descriptions of the Jewish Sabbath made it appear, I quote, almost worse than the Scotch Sunday, as depicted by continental observers. End of quote. So with respect to scholarship in particular, both Smith and Schachter certainly believed in complementarity, Schachter telling Smith on one occasion, you Christians know Hebrew grammar, we know Hebrew, we need not be dissatisfied with the division. Thank you very much.